Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, all right. It is Monday, and it's time for What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. And we are going to have some serious insights today, people, because my guest is none other than the one, the only, the inimitable Steve Jenkins. I barely need to introduce this guest because, first of all, he's been on the network so often, but secondly, because he is literally synonymous with good food and gourmet food in the United States, as well as around the world. Steve Jenkins, in case you don't know who he is the author of The Cheese Primer, which was one of the very first books about international cheeses that nobody had ever heard of or seen before. He is the longtime resident genius at Fairway Markets. He has won innumerable awards, domestic and international, in his discerning palate for cheese, for olive oils, for marketing, for you name it. Steve has done it. And he is an expert basically on all things food. What an incredible life this guy has had. And he's just getting started, right, Steve? Now he has an incredible new import business called, not surprisingly, Steve Jenkins Imports. Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network, Steve. It's so great to have you on.
Sounds like I'm striving mightily to remain relevant, and you made it sound like I'm somebody would actually want to listen to.
Are you kidding me? Of course you're somebody would want to listen to. I always want to listen to you, even if nobody else does. But I think most people will want to listen to you. Come on, what a reputation you have, man. You have been at the forefront of the quote-unquote gourmet food industry since it really started ramping up back in the 70s, which is when I remember it. You and I started out kind of around the same time. I worked at Pasta and Cheese. Didn't you work there, too?
I sure did, from right when I quit Giorgio and Joel Dean and DeLuca, and I went to work for Henry Lambert, who I'm having lunch with today, Katie.
Stop it!
At Pasta and Cheese. And Henry Lambert was the guy who got Marcella Hazan to write up his fresh pasta that he made in Long Island City and had trucked into his shops on the Upper East Side. It was a very cool thing he did before anybody had any notion of boiling fresh noodles, fresh pasta in their kitchen and pouring some gloppy tomato sauce on it. But he made a huge success out of it. And he's amazing,
sure,
amazing man.
It's real. I can't believe the guy's still alive, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean,
and he doesn't look a day older than when you and I knew him back in 79 for me.
Yeah.
You were several years later because you're a lot younger than I am. But
I am not, no.
But he still looks the same as he did when I met him in 79. It's
incredible.
Amazing. Henry Lambert. He was Saul Steinberg's top guy. Remember back in the 80s when you'd read in the newspapers about that mogul Saul Steinberg who lived on the East Side with Gayfrid, his society wife? I never met them, but I've told they were nice people, but he had a reputation for being a real shark. Henry was his top guy.
Wow.
Henry had a chauffeured Mercedes. He was so important to Saul Steinberg, one of the original billionaires, one of the original guys that we would heap scorn on because they owned everything.
Everything.
He was the Stephen Schwartzman of his day. But it all started way back then, but everything's all linked and hooked together.
It is. I mean, in a way, that was the story. I mean, Dean and DeLuca existed because you came from Dean and DeLuca, and Balducci's existed. But Pasta and Cheese, to me, was the store chain. There were like six or seven stores at its top, and they were the ones who really brought that international cuisine into everybody's home. They were the first ones to really make it popular to, you know, that was when raspberry vinegar was a thing, right?
Oh, it's amazing. It's just amazing. It was 77. I became the first person hired to work at Dean and DeLuca, Joel's and Giorgio's wonderful shop, and Jack Chiglick's wonderful shop,
right,
on Prince Street at Wooster, between Wooster and something else. But anyway, it was, there wasn't even a decent bottle. There wasn't a real bottle of olive oil in Dean and DeLuca.
No.
77, 78, and 79. Opened in the summer of 77.
Wow.
And, you know, we had this wonderful buzz about how cool we were for all the great food. But indeed, even in those days, Katie, there was no good olive oil. It took it until I quit Giorgio and Joel and went to work for Pasta and Cheese, did I get my hands on real extra virgin olive oil, and I put it in all of our shops at Pasta and Cheese.
Yeah.
I think I find that to be just absolutely amazing.
Well, it's sort of
but it was Giorgio and me that pioneered the balsamic vinegar in 78.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I still love balsamic vinegar. I'm guilty
as charged. You and everybody else, for sure. But now there's PX sherry vinegar, and there's Lambrusco vinegar, and
yeah,
there's a ton of great sweet vinegars that are just as enjoyable and addictive as balsamic.
Absolutely. But the thing that really, for me, Pasta and Cheese, I don't want to stay too long on this particular chapter of your history, but...
Sorry, my fault.
But no, not at all. Because I think it's important for people to remember that this, like, we didn't have this stuff so long ago.
No, it evolved.
You know?
It happened because there were maniacs.
Yeah, and
like
the
you,
cheese buying like me, program, like you.
Who insisted on having the real deal and not some trumped up fake thing from the United States trying to imitate a European standard that had been around for 1,000 years, like balsamic vinegar.
That's right. But for me, it was the cheese education that I got there that was just, has, you know, left me a lifelong cheeseaholic.
Well, thank
for
you
better
very
or
much.
Worse.
That
yeah, no, I mean, really.
Me.
That was you. Yeah. I mean, and you were going off to these little villages and finding these incredible cheeses. And I remember, like, when the USDA suddenly slammed the door shut on raw milk cheeses, and that was like a big deal. And
yeah,
anyway.
I made a career out of smuggling.
Yeah.
And you know what's weird is that nobody else cared about it but me. That's why I got to be successful and got a reputation, because I chose to do something nobody else seemed to care about.
That's right. And then you wrote the cheese primer. Once you jumped to Fairway, I think you were at Fairway already when you wrote
that. Yeah, I got to Fairway in 80.
Yeah, wow.
After I left Henry Lambert, I went to this market nobody had ever heard of called
That's
Fairway
right.
up on 74th and Broadway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's how that evolved.
Now, how did you, I want to ask you this, how did you go from being the international man of cheese to being the, you know, the basically the apostle of olive oil?
Oh, because by 96, I was getting paid so much that they wanted me to do other things. And I had pioneered all these non-cheese items into Fairway, and I had hired some really talented people to run my operation.
Yeah.
And it just behooved my partners to make me do other things than just pay attention to cheese. So I started importing everything direct to Fairway. And that's why you wanted to talk to me today, is why and how did that evolve? And that
Absolutely.
Was purely because I lost patience with the local importers and distributors who had me a slave to whatever it is they chose to import and distribute.
Right.
They didn't know anything about food. They weren't passionate about food. They didn't study and study and study night after night and travel like I did on my own money to learn and get turned on to rock and roll ancient staples of Europe that defined the entire realm of gastronomy. That was a lowly counter guy who got good, who got better and better as the years went by, and Fairway got famous and became a destination store because we were all good merchants at Fairway, and also because I stopped relying on the local importers and distributors on their same old stuff.
Yeah.
You could find up and down the street in any Korean store or any place, you know, even a food emporium. I stopped saying, this is crazy. I'm bringing in my own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it happened.
And that's how you have evolved now into having your own label.
Well, yeah,
Steve
I
Jenkins
retired two and a half years ago because Fairway we were bought out by a private equity group.
That's
and
right.
That was immediately no good. In my mind, I wasn't going to be able to deal with those guys from Greenwich, so I got out, and I realized, well, my God, I'm only, you know, 60-something, and I'm at the height of my powers, and I've been pioneering all these cheeses and non-cheese items for 15 years, some of them almost 20.
Right.
And it was a stable of exclusives that weren't being sold in any other stores but my Fairway stores. And I said to myself, why don't I just share these with the better retailers across the country and certainly in this area, so that I can continue to keep my feet in the water and widely disseminate all these killer olive oils and chocolates and all kinds of things that are in my stable that nobody else has.
Yeah, that's I know. Your website is unbelievable. I mean, the products that you have are not what I would have expected from, you know, Mr. Olive Oil, Cheese,
yeah,
and Vinegar.
Well, they were all Fairway items. You couldn't buy anyplace else. So I distilled it down from, you know, so over 100 little European companies, Katie, to like 50-something, the ones that were real winners for me at Fairway that really sold, and then I reordered and re-imported time after month after month after month since, you know, the late 90s.
Right.
And they're all winners. They're all things that me and my friends and people that I care about getting invited to their house to eat dinner, stuff that they're used to having because I always would bring it to them or they would buy it in one of my Fairway stores. And you just can't find this stuff anyplace else. And now these knuckleheads that operate Fairway haven't reordered any of these things because they don't know how to import. They think it's too much trouble.
Well that was going to be my next question. Yeah, absolutely. Well, talk a little bit about the import business. Like, so who are you selling your stuff to? Why doesn't Fairway just use you as the broker then?
Well, for one thing, I haven't offered to be that to them, and they haven't reached out, so I don't know. There's a lot of things that I don't know about that I don't care about.
Okay.
Because at my age,
you
just
afford
don't care
that.
About all those things that you used to. If, you know, if somebody was going to blow smoke up my bottom and say, oh, we've got to have all that stuff that we used to have, well, you know, I'd probably take a meeting, but, you know, they haven't reached out. So I'm going, this has only just started.
Yeah.
My wife, Michelle, made this website in about 10 days, so it's not rocket science. It's just very handsome.
Oh, yeah.
Very accessible. It's stevejenkinsimports.com. It's fun to go to, fun to look at.
It is. Great photos.
A website that you can do yourself if you've got somebody talented like your wife.
Yeah, really. I could have used it on mine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I couldn't have done it in a million years. And she sat down and did it in about 10 days.
God bless. Wow.
Blows my mind.
That's
it's so
impressive.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So you want to see some very cool stuff, you go to stevejenkinsimports.com. And the catalog password is 111.
That's right. So check it out, folks, because really there's an amazing
stuff. No big deal. No big deal. But it's very
there.
Cool to see all the stuff you're missing now that Fairway has receded into the woodwork and really is just an ordinary chain of supermarkets now.
So,
I hate to say it.
Kinda, yeah, absolutely.
Kinda, totally.
Yeah, yep.
Breaks my heart.
I bet
absolutely
it does.
Absolutely breaks my heart.
Yeah, of course.
That's the way things go sometimes.
It is, but you have risen from the ashes, and here you have a new import business, and you're going to be selling into all kinds of specialty stores before you know it. So is that your goal?
This is not self-serving, Katie. This is, you know, I'm
sure
mostly dealing out of town, so this is not something where I'm humping my website to do business. It's a thing of beauty. It's the stuff that you guys used to love to find at Fairway that you couldn't find anyplace
else. Absolutely.
Those early harvest olive oils that are monocultivars and all those great vinegars and things.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the olive oil, for instance, because you were mentioning that you were in the New York International Olive Oil Competition.
Yeah, that was our baby, my baby.
What was that
about? We underwrote it for the first 3 years of its existence, and last month was the fourth, and it was a smash. I didn't speak at this one last month, but I spoke at the first three, and that was really neat because I've got to meet so many cool people that are olive farmers and olive millers and olive experts that have PhDs and all of that. I got to meet Frank Giustra. Oh my God. You got 20 minutes, I'll tell you. Frank Giustra, who was a polymath.
Uh-huh. We love those
anybody
polymaths,
out there
don't
that
we?
Wants that wants to get in the know about somebody who's ruling the world, Google Frank Giustra.
Is that Giustra?
It's a Giustra.
Yeah, I thought
so. Just as sort of a mission, has created the most expensive olive oil in the bloody world.
Is that right? What makes it so costly?
It's gobsmacking how expensive this olive oil is from Umbria that's in a steel bottle.
Ooh.
And where Frank came from, Katie, it's a mind blower.
Really?
Oh, my God.
What makes his olive oil so spectacular?
Well, first of all, he's got the best miller imaginable. There's maybe a handful of millers that are have the mettle and experience that Cesare has for Frank Giustra in Umbria, for Domenica Fiore, named after Frank's mother, Domenica Fiore.
Uh-huh.
And he's got extraordinary groves that are very, very specific as to what the cultivar is.
Uh-huh.
And he refuses to blend cultivars, which, if we had the time, I would explain why that's a noble thing to do.
Uh-huh.
And he's hit a grand slam home run with everything he's done. Frank Giustra is Lionsgate Studios.
Oh.
He decided he wanted to make movies after he'd already made billions in mining.
Oh, wow.
And before that, a hedge fund back in the 80s, 90s.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
He's 10 years younger than me, this guy.
Oh, my God. From
Vancouver.
Don't you just hate them?
But anyway, his olive oil is drop-dead fabulous.
Wow.
And I should know.
You are the
but
guru, man. You are the guru.
Anybody that would pay that kind of money for... Well, for anything. I mean, olive oil is a great value, even if it's $30, $40 a liter.
Yeah.
But this stuff is almost twice that.
Oh, my gosh.
And anybody that can afford to buy olive oil that expensive ought to be firebombed for conspicuous consumerism. I'm halfway kidding. I'm halfway serious. I mean, come on.
Yeah,
come
you on. Have to, like, drink it out of a shot glass. I mean, you can't just,
well,
like...
exactly. The hoity-toity chef brings it to the table himself rather than
right.
the wait staff and,
right, right.
and dribbles it over your crudo. I mean, somebody blow my brains out already.
Well, God, Steve, you do have some very strong opinions about the food business. I wonder, one of the things that you wrote to me when we were talking about setting up this interview is, and this is your quote, is how every shop and supermarket is such a slave to the consolidation of what's available to the serious mm-hmm. foodie and food merchant.
Mm-hmm.
And you intend to change all that. But like that sort of speaks to the what we were talking about earlier about sort of being beholden to what distributors bring in. Is that what you were talking about when you meant the consolidation of the market?
Oh, it's even worse than you think, and everybody out there, listen to me. I mean, the specialty food industry has consolidated, amalgamated, you know, merged into where there's like only two big importers and distributors left.
Really?
So what everybody up and down the street, whether you're a supermarket or a specialty store or a boutique or some dopey shop in a airport,
right,
is what these two big outfits have chosen to make available to you. And my whole thing is that's insane. Anybody that's a retailer or a cook or a chef or a restaurateur ought to be taking every spare moment that they have and traveling.
Yeah.
And traveling to the region where you're most interested in the cuisine. And in doing so, you're getting around to the markets and to the farmers markets and
right.
to the shops and to the restaurants, and you're getting turned on to specific ingredients made by very specific people that, by God, you ought to be pioneering. You ought to be going to that person's place of business or home or farm or grove or whatever and finding the person responsible and saying, hi, how are ya? And oh, yeah. And we hope you can speak a little bit of his or her language and say, I want to buy as much of this stuff as you can sell to me. I'll have it picked up by my freight forwarder. I'll have it sent to the nearest port, and I'll have it customs cleared and duty paid in New York, and you're going to get amazing publicity from some food writer that's everybody's going to be beating the path to your door. And you also say, I'm not going to make you change your way of life. I don't want you to ramp up your production just to satisfy my desire to mm-hmm. get my hands on a quantity of your product. I'll take just whatever you can spare. You know, I've been doing that for 15 years, and that's how I got this stable of suppliers mm. that are loyal to me and that cherish my business and that love getting that big check of euros every month mm. when I reorder. And it's because of passion. It's not because of business. It's because I don't want that stuff that those two imported distributors offer. They haven't done their homework. They haven't traveled. They're not passionate about what they're doing.
We're going to take a quick break right here and wait for a sponsor drop, and then we'll be right back with more of Steve Jenkins. Stay tuned.
I'm Mike Colomeco, host of Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, as well as Ray and Tom Williams, who've worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray, Tom, why is organic farming so important to your family?
It's all a matter of the soil is a source of nutrients. you increase organic matter of the soil, you increase the water holding capacity. Water is becoming increasingly scarce. So in terms of sustainability, we don't think it's the only answer, but it's one answer, and it's the answer that we're trying to pursue.
It's been a challenge, and it's been fun, because it is different, and we're learning how to do it for the last 10-plus years.
We're not just doing organic. We're doing organic to high standards.
Bob, why did you choose to partner with Ray and Tom?
Oh, goodness. Well, because they're the best farmers in Oregon, and they're close, and they have a bunch of acres, I think about 10,000, over in eastern Oregon and Washington. They're wonderful farmers, and their family have been farmers over there for many, many years.
It's really important that you have long-term relationships, and we've enjoyed a long-term relationship with Bob's, because there are a lot of challenges to organic farming. You simply don't have as many tools as a conventional farmer, and so you have to rely on longer-term solutions.
Knowing that you have a market is absolutely critical. The margins in farming are not that great, so if you grow the stuff and you can't sell it, you have a real problem. And we know with Bob's that we have a market, and we turn out high-quality grains, and they buy them, and it all works well.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
We are back. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and you're listening to What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and my guest today is Steve Jenkins. On with the show! So how did it get to be that point where it is only just the two big importers that are?
Because all the little people were being crowded out by those big guys. They couldn't make any money. It's very, very difficult to make any money as an importer distributor. You're running trucks.
Yeah.
Cost a fortune. You got salesmen you got to pay. You got expenses of the salesmen you got to pay.
Yeah.
You've got enormous persecution by the FDA, who's constantly up your behind and fining you and detaining product, and all of that costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
I don't know of anybody who's been doing what I'm doing that's walking away wealthy. So they all sold out for whatever they could to these guys who became the behemoths of the industry. You see their trucks on the street. You
Which
see
ones?
Chef's Warehouse
Chef's
trucks
Warehouse,
on the street.
Yeah.
You see Ace Endico on every highway you're on. You see Baldor trucks every place.
I see Baldor everywhere.
And now, for the non-perishables, it's all Kehe. Mm-hmm. K-E-H-E, and UNFI, which used to be the organic and health food distributor that's now one of two great specialty food importer distributors. But their stable can't hold a candle to mine, because they haven't done their rock and roll history business. They don't understand what the business of supplying ingredients and immediate gratuitous foodstuffs is. They handle big, huge European companies, and I'm talking really, this is very Eurocentric, the conversation you and I are having.
Yes.
I'm not talking Asian stuff, and I'm not talking South American stuff, though I do have some killer stuff from Rio. I'm talking Europe. And about my violon d'angre, which is French for hobby, for what I've loved to do for the last 25, 30 years, which is wander around in France and Italy and Spain and Portugal and Belgium and Holland and Scandinavia, and look for stuff that tastes really good, and stuff that I could get palletized and have a truck pick up for me and send it to either Le Havre in Normandy or to Barcelona or to Genoa, so that it can get containerized, those pallets, and then come across the ocean to Port Elizabeth, New Jersey. And I can get my hands on it. My joy all these years of being a cheesemonger, and I'm a master cheesemonger. There was nobody better than me at the counter for all those years. I was the best counterman in the world. The greatest thing in the world was to get a wooden box that was filled with, say, a great goat cheese from the Perigord region.
Yeah.
And use your right hand and pry off that top slat, and inside, nestled on top of rye straw mats, which was like Vox amplifier speakers like the Beatles used to have to me.
Yeah.
These rye straw mats, where all these goat cheeses that would have shapes and have names that would describe the shape,
yep,
and would be named after the village that they came from, would nestle upon these rye straw mats so that air could pass underneath them. That, for me, was the greatest thrill in the universe. And today, it's the same thing. When I get in a case of Oleo Estepa olive oil from just east of Seville, or the Basilipo that's closer over to Baena, or the Orizzi Provençal olive oil, and I open it up and I look at that bottle and I look at, I mean, that, it's just such a rush.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
And you're not going to find that in stores that much anymore, because there's nobody that's passionate that's doing the importing and distributing, and it's something that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it's sad when things that used to be real specialty items have become commoditized.
Yeah.
Even if their quality is good, I still am looking for, I'm still longing for those old days where you would, you know, find some really extraordinary treasure.
Yeah, what I tell you, what else you're longing for is to have it, having stores like Fairway around that didn't charge so much money.
Ugh, no kidding.
I mean, all of this stuff is so elitist. Most people aren't going to rustle up the money to be able to buy a great bottle of olive oil. Let's be serious. That stuff's expensive. That's why Fairway was so successful, because I was in there cutting out the broker, the distributor, and the importer. It was all about my customer dealing directly with the people that were weeding the grove and pruning the olive trees and everything else. I cut out all those people in between so I could charge a price where the best bottle of olive oil in North America from one of my 15 barrel oils that I'd import direct would cost $15.
Yeah.
That's a steal. Now they're $45, $55, $60 for a liter. But when I do it my way, it's $15, $16, and that's the way it ought to be, because, you know, most people just are not going to scrape together that kind of money to satisfy their desire to do the things that I've been doing for the last 35 years, and I feel bad about that. So my job's to keep this stuff as low priced as I possibly can, but still has the quality that I would insist upon for Fairway in the old days before 2.5 years ago.
Right, absolutely. You know, you mentioned that nobody cooks, but I think quite a lot of people are heading back into the kitchen.
Don't surprise me.
well, I wanted to ask you about the meal kit companies that have sprung up like mushrooms.
Yeah.
What do you think? Are those flash in the pans, or are they
cooking? On the strength of what I've just learned last week is I've got one of them that's begging me to come up with 128,000 2-ounce portions of ricotta salata for their bloody box of ingredients going out there. And they're talking about reordering monthly. That's 16,000 pounds of the sheep's milk cheese that's made from whey in Sardinia and Sicily.
Yeah.
So I'm trying mightily to find somebody who will fill this, get the labor done on these 6-pound wheels of ricotta salata to crumble it into 2-ounce portions.
That's what I was just going to say.
Into a little plastic soufflé dish with a tight lid on it so that I can do this deal.
Yeah.
That says to me, this is real.
This is real. There's money there. And then I was thinking for you, for olive oil also, this would be a tremendous opportunity because, I mean, 2-ounce portions of olive oil as a drizzle or, you know,
but they don't need me. There's 150 other guys out there who are ready and willing to serve 2-ounce portions of erstwhile olive oil for these guys that are trying to keep their costs down so that their orders will go up.
I don't know.
So
they can use you as marketing.
Just like everything else does.
Why can't they use you as a marketing tool? Steve Jenkins Select.
Well, they ought to.
I mean,
you know,
it's a branding.
I can articulate the significance of what it is they're trying to do in a manner by which people will say, well, you know, if he says it's okay, I guess it's okay.
Right.
But, you know, that remains to be seen.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You got to put on some Steve Jenkins magic for that, because, honestly, that's worth it.
But, you know, Katie, we've got to keep the she out of this thing. We've got to stop with the snobby thing and understand that there's people like you and me around that just want their best friends to come over and settle down and open some wine bottles or have some cocktails, and let's cook dinner together, having shopped for it that day someplace that gave us joy.
Yes, right.
I was in a Publix in North Carolina last month.
Really?
Which is one of the leading supermarket chains in the world, along with Kroger and a few others, Publix. And I came out, and for the next 3 or 4 days, I was so depressed, I couldn't figure out why. And then it dawned on me that the experience of shopping in Publix was the most dispiriting experience I have had in I don't remember when.
Why did you feel that way?
And food people have been dumbed down to the degree of a Publix. I just don't know what to say. I mean, it's like I'm Johnny come late. I've stayed too long at the fair. I can't take it anymore. Katie, it was just awful.
Really? Because I find my locals are getting better and better in Rhode Island, which was truly a food desert 10 years ago.
Which chain?
Even the Stop and Shop there is pretty good. I actually shop in a market that's an independent called the Belmont, which is excellent. But the Stop and Shop there is really quite creditable. I mean, I've been amazed. Yeah,
that's the Golub family. They've always done a good job, but I don't believe you. I don't believe you. And people say the same thing about Wegmans.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've never shopped there.
They say I had an okay shopping experience at Stop and Shop. I don't agree. I think it's just loathsome the way they merchandise food, the way they don't have anybody on the floor to talk about it with you, the way
That's
they
true.
Don't think signage is important to try and inform you, the way they make the visual of it, that it's so behind glass and so packaged. And then there's the selection that is it's just execrable, the selection. The cheeses that were offered to me in that Publix in a major, major neighborhood of Raleigh, North Carolina, which is a world-class city.
Yeah.
Was an absolute embarrassment. I could not believe my eyes how bad it was. So I hate to be Debbie Downer, but I don't think things are turning out quite the way
we had hoped.
And a lot of folks that are listening want things to turn out.
Yeah, well, I would agree with you that the cheese and salumi and, you know, that kind of stuff is really a dismal situation in any grocery store chain. Very bad. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the produce has gone way, way up. And the, you know, even the selection of meat has started to include some better options than in days of yore.
The butchers and the fishmongers are as good as they can be, I would say. Some of them, anyway.
Be
but take prepared foods. You know, they should refer to that department as leftovers.
Yeah, right.
And it's leftovers of dishes that nobody really found much joy in the first place.
I don't know who buys
like
that
cold
stuff.
Leftovers of not very good food to begin with.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what folks are eating out there. Those folks that think Boston Market is pretty good, or the Golden Corral. Have you ever been in a Golden Corral? That is a mind blower.
I literally never, ever. I mean, it's not that I'm a snob. It's just that I don't like that kind of food particularly.
Yeah, well, I do.
Yeah.
I love that kind of food, but I'm a snob. I'm a reverse snob, I guess. I just.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say without sounding like a jerk. But the state of shopping for food out there is just really bad, really bad.
And, yeah.
And
well,
the more it's summertime, when there's good summertime food and farmers markets and some independent markets that are offering stuff from nearby, I mean, maybe that's all we can hope for.
Maybe.
But all my stuff's imported, and it's not perishable food. It's stuff that's shelf-stable that there's not an equivalent made in North America. This is the old established European stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of that, you mentioned a project that you're working on with someone named Matthew Battaglia, a Tuscan olive oil farmer.
Yes.
And so you've been importing his olive oil for years, and then you said that you're doing some project with the state of Texas.
Yes, he's got a charcuterie guy, a salamiere, and he's got a cheesemaker way over near the Gulf, outside of Brownsville. And the cheesemaker's making a drop-dead goat cheese, and we're importing a sheep's cheese for him in its young state that he's putting away, having swathe it with local chilies, which sounds gimmicky, but it's absolutely remarkable what happens after that stuff's been in a cave for a bloody Gulf of Mexico sand cave for 6 months, swathed in these chilies, and his own goat cheeses that he's doing the same thing with.
Uh-huh.
And the Salumiere, who is over closer to Austin, he is knocking off not just great salsiche, fresh and aged, but he's knocking off my passion, which is called copiette.
What is that?
Copiette is the Italian word meaning paired, doubles, two of something. And in this case, it's dried pork tenderloin that's been pounded with fennel seed and sea salt and hot dried red chili flakes, and then aged until it's like the texture of the most toothsome jerky you've ever had.
Mm.
Copiette is a Roman phenomenon from thousands of years ago that's been around forever because every truck driver in Italy has a plastic bag filled with copiette very close to his gearbox. So that in between downshifting and upshifting and double clutching, this guy reaches in this plastic bag and pulls out a hunk of copiette and gnaws on it across the miles of Europe that these truck drivers are driving. And they're utterly addicted to it, as am I. I found it in a shop that specialized in Sardinian stuff on the highway between Monte Argentario and Rome.
Wow.
Between that fabulous island there and Rome, there's a shop where if on a clear day you can see Corsica. You can't see Sardinia, but you can see Corsica.
Wow.
And everything in this little shop right on the roadside is Erbitello. Erbitello is the word, the city I was trying to think of, which is the mouth of Monte Argentario, the island off the coast that's connected by these ganglion. This shop had that copiette in there, and I've been addicted to it for 10 years now.
Wow.
And nobody makes it. There's like two people in Italy that make it.
Wow.
And nobody in the United States. And the stuff is just, it's absolutely drop-dead, delicious, fabulous, so addictive. You know, you go in an airport, and you'll see a whole huge kiosk festooned with all of this loathsome, just gross, nausea-inducing jerky that's flavored with this and that and the other thing, and it's expensive. Have you seen those jerky kiosks?
Yes.
And across the country at truck stops, it's the most valuable real estate in the whole massive truck stop is where they sell the jerky. Well, there's a huge market for that horrible stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I've got this thing coming out that's like, it's like prosciutto ends that have been hammered, pounded with a mallet with fennel seed and sea salt and hot dried red chili flakes. And it
sounds absolutely great.
So we've got
this thing
going with Matthew's
now.
Olive oil and the charcutier, Salumiere, near Austin, and the cheesemaker. And we've got a pizza maker down there who's feeding these pizzas to all of the military bases.
Ah.
And we've got Franciacorta, who is Antinori, getting involved with this huge batch of red wine that they're not selling to anybody else. And it looks like it's shaping up to a pretty neat thing. And I've been working with Matthew on this for more than 5 years, more like 7 years.
Wow.
I've been tolerating this whack job who lives in Camaiore with his two young sons and his brother, and this is his entrepreneurial wacko thing that I've been patient with for 6-7 years, and it looks like it's coming to fruition based on the relationships he has with Texas. Oh, and the other thing is the mullet burgers. He's got this guy who catches 300,000 pounds of mullet in the panhandle of Florida and sells the roe to Italians and doesn't have anything to do with all of that mullet meat, which is absolutely delicious. You know, the ultimate smoked fish is not sturgeon or salmon or whitefish or chubs like we think out here in New York.
Right.
The ultimate smoked fish is mullet.
Who knew?
So this guy, I've been eating it for years because that's, you know, I came from Missouri and we always took vacations in Florida and we would always buy a whole big bags of smoked mullet the same way Italian truck drivers buy copiette and we would always have it in the car. So there are many of those of us who know great, how great smoked mullet is, and this guy's making these mullet burgers out of it that are frozen that taste like the best roasted fish that you could buy.
Oh, wow.
And it's cheap
great.
As dirt. So we've got that thrown into the mix, too. If it isn't one thing, it's another.
I mean, Steve, your energy is just extraordinary. So now how did this...
I'm retired.
Yeah, right. Plenty of time on your hands. But it doesn't sound like you have any time on your hands because, I mean, between the two of these projects, that sounds like pretty major. And plus you go around still giving talks and obviously looking for products.
Yeah, and talking to anybody that he needs to have a good talking to.
That's right.
That's what I do. You know, but at the same time, I'm as much of a phony and a dilettante as you could imagine. I just love how things taste, and I just love cramming things in my mouth.
Yes.
And I can't wait for this guy near Austin, Mark, his name is Mark, to make another big batch of Colpiette and send it to me, and for Adam Thompson to make another big batch of his goat cheese that's swaddled in these gorgeous local chilies.
What kind
send
of
another
flavor
big batch
does that?
Of that? To me, it's all that part of our conversation, Katie, is self-interest.
Well,
I love getting free stuff in the mail.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm just going to say, I'd be up for getting some of that free stuff in the mail, too. Tell me about the flavor of the chilies, because like when I traveled to Vietnam, for example, the chilies have a lot of, it's more than just heat. It's like a very floral flavor, like a variety of floral flavors. So is that what's happening with the cheeses that are wrapped in chilies?
Has nothing to do with that.
Right.
You know, I've always eschewed, I've always heaped scorn on food makers that think they have to put stuff in stuff. I hate stuff in stuff.
Mm-hmm. I know, me
this
too.
This is something entirely different, just as you said. It's not a hot chili. It's a chili that's got this enormous depth of flavor. It's a pasilla and a poblano that he swaddles this with. And over time, that complexity of those non-hot chilies, those spicy but non-hot chilies, imbue that cheese. It's about a 4-5 pounder to where not only is there no mold involved, but the result is you can eat the outside of that cheese, too. So it's like you've got an accompaniment with that cheese, and it's not an ingredient that's been introduced to the interior. It has only been attached to the exterior in order to flavor, in order to imbue the interior with that mysterious, dark, smoky, savory, umami-driven chili into that otherwise rather bland cheese.
Sure. It sounds absolutely brilliant.
And if it didn't have that integrity, I wouldn't be into it because, as I say, I don't like it when you trick something up. This is a totally legitimate way to bring a cheese to where it's been heightened, it's been refined, it's become better than it came before.
Right.
You know, it's like cleaning up a campsite before you leave. It looks better now than when I got here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's what affinage is all about, right?
Precisely.
It's like you get a sort of a raw, for a better lack of a better word, a raw ingredient, and then depending on what you rub it with, or you have in the cave, or you smear on it, or
that's the purpose.
It's like it's like rubbing it with Burgundy or Mark or something like that. By the way,
so
do you have a cheese cave?
He's the real deal.
Yeah. What about you? You don't do it as a hobby?
Affinage? I did it as a hobby for all those years where I was a master cheesemonger, and suddenly it became chic to dedicate a room to become what all of these Americans love to roll off of their tongue and palate, the word affineur.
Yes.
And I was the only one that had the temerity or the audacity to stand up and decry a phony baloney practice because it didn't require that kind of elitist attitude toward it. I've been doing it for years naturally because I had a walk-in box that I could control the humidity and the temperature in various areas of that room. But I resisted that fad of a few years ago of affinage, just the very three syllables of it annoy me. And that guy Hervé had to come from France and walk around with a lab coat on and a clipboard and a temperature and humidity devices in his lab coat pocket. For a fee, he would turn you into an affineur so that you could commit affinage. I thought that was absolutely one of the dumbest things that New Yorkers have come up with, and I said so, and everybody said, "Oh well, he's just too old."
That's right.
He's just
that's
he didn't
just
think
Steve
of it.
So being grumpy.
What crap?
Yeah.
I'm a master cheesemonger. I've been into affinage for before most of these kids were born.
Yeah, sure, of course. Well, you were the first guy who was doing it here. I mean,
affinage.
Basically.
Get out of here. This is ridiculous. Put the cheese away and go look at it every day and turn it upside down and rub it if you want. But get Hervé out of my face already, please.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap up with one final question, which is what food writers do you read, if any? Do you still enjoy reading?
You know who I am? Is this woman who writes for the Epoch Times.
No kidding.
Which 127 million people go to that digital website a month.
Wow, I had
read
no
that
idea.
In the Wikipedia because I wanted to see how wacky are these people, Epoch Times. And it turns out Epoch Times is a bunch of lovely people who happen to be religious in terms of the baby Jesus, which is neither here nor there, but are mightily and viciously persecuted by the Chi-Coms. And our media over the last decade have sort of vilified Falun Gong as being a bunch of Bible-thumping nitwit nutcases. It's not the case. They're very legitimate, and if you read up on them and read some of the history of them, you'll find that they're really very lovely people. Now, I'm as irreligious as anybody ever walked up and down the street, but the Epoch Times has a writer named Chanelle Philip. She also uses the last name Oum, O-U-M. I don't know where that came from, but I know her as Chanelle Philip in the Epoch Times, and she has a body of work that's readily available online that absolutely blows my mind.
No kidding.
You've got, my listeners, you've got to go check out Chanelle Philip at the Epoch Times. She's the best writer, besides Regina Schrambling, that I've come across in my career. And there's nobody better than Regina Schrambling.
I would agree with that.
That being said, the loathsome New York Times has some extremely talented people, and Christine Mulkey and Kim Severson and Sam Sifton. I love them to death. I despise their newspaper, but I absolutely am in awe of those folks.
I do love
name?
Kim Severson.
I'm forgetting that other writer.
Stephanie
Nisha
Strong?
What's her name? Nisha? Anyway, there's two other writers.
Nisha Lowry, I think
blow
it
my
is.
Mind.
Yeah.
But Regina Schrambling, who is gastropoda.com.
Yeah.
And she's been throwing some recipes to the New York Times recently. And she quit them twice. She hates the New York Times, too.
Oh, yeah.
She's thrown some recipes their way over the last few months. And Chanelle Philip at Epoch Times, I feel so glad that you just asked me that, because I can't tell you how knocked out I am by Regina's work and Chanelle Phillips' work in the Epoch Times. Her everything she's written over the last 10 years is there, and it's just one mind blower after another. She even wrote about Alex Atala's joint in Sao Paulo. His joint is called DOM, Dome, but it does D period, O period, M period. It's one of those great restaurants that none of us will ever get to unless you get to give a keynote speech at the South American Supermarket Industries Convention like I did. It's the only reason I got to go to this restaurant. It was book solid, but I went and hung around in the lobby, Michelle and my wife and I, and they finally said, okay, we'll get a table over here. It's the only way I got to eat there. But
wow.
Alex Atala's joint. Chanelle even wrote a piece about him. I mean, she picks the most... She picks all these subject matter that I'm dying to read about. And I can't say that for most other food writers.
Yeah, really, me too. Steve, I got to wrap it up here, but thank you so much for joining me today. This has been really fun. I'm definitely going to tweet out to Regina that you gave her a huge thumbs up on the show today.
She'll enjoy that. And there's nobody I'd rather talk to than you.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And thank you to my engineer. And we'll talk to you next week, folks. Thanks for listening. And this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. Signing off for now.
For listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.